I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Community and Regional Affairs to order. For the record, it is 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, March 26th, 2019. We're in the Belts Room of the Thomas Stewart Building. Present today are Senators Hoffman, Senator Costello, Senator Birch, myself, Senator Bishop, and Senator Gray Jackson is excused and not at today's meeting. And I'd like to recognize Christopher Dickrell, Senate Records. Good afternoon, sir. Mr. Bridges, sir, thank you. And Cody Grusendorf from my office. We know the cell phone drill. Today we have one item on our agenda. We have a presentation on power cost equalization overview by Mira Kohler from Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Today's information is informational. There will be no testimony other than questions back and forth from committee members. And would you like to entertain questions at the end of each slide, or how would you like to do this?
It's completely up to you.
Okay.
You're welcome to interrupt any time, and if it occurs that I've got a slide a little later on explaining exactly what you're asking, I'll direct you to that one.
Thank you, ma'am. And please introduce yourself to the public for the record and start your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Mira Kohler. I am the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. I'm going to give you a little overview about Alaska Village Electric a little later on in the presentation, but my purpose here today is to talk to you about power cost equalization. The reason you've invited me is because I've been involved with this program since before its inception, in fact, since the very first one of its precursors. So I have lived, eaten, breathed it, maybe not as deeply as one of your members here. So I'm a little nervous about being judged by him, because there is no question in my mind that he is the master here. So I'm just trying to give you a perspective from a user perspective. So with that, I will move to my first slide. I take you back to glance at 1977, which is, in effect, the year that the pipeline started flowing. It also is a year when Alaska was very much struggling to emerge from a very vast, underserved state. And at that time, in 1977, there was almost no transmission in Alaska. There was really one line that came from the Beluga gas fields, where Chugach had built their gas generation plant in 1968, and that brought power back to Anchorage. They were, at that point in time, the primary provider for both Homer Electric and Matanuska Electric. Fairbanks was entirely on their own generation of power. It was mostly coal and heavy oil locally. And everywhere else was diesel fuel. Even the rail belt communities, Matanuska, Chugach, Homer, Seward, et cetera, had all been on diesel fuel until very recently before this time. There was very little hydropower in the state. There was the Kutna Hydro Project, which had been built by Anchorage actually back in the 1930s. And then was rebuilt by the federal government. It was a 30 megawatt project that served Municipal Light and Power, Chugach, and Matanuska Electric. There was a 20 megawatt Cooper Lake project, Snettisham, which is still the primary source of power here in Juneau, and a handful of projects scattered around southeast Alaska. So that was the picture back then. So once oil started flowing, obviously, wealth started flowing into the state coffers, and the state started looking at their primary priority at that time, which was energy, and started to look for what might be some major solutions for affordable energy for Alaska, because as we all know, without affordable energy, there can be no economic development, there can be no prosperity. Everything hinges upon the availability of energy. So several projects were begun at that time in the late 70s and early 80s. The Susitna Mega Project, this was the 1600 megawatt project. Original project was begun, the design work. The Bradley Lake Project was begun to be thought of. The Four Dam Pool Projects were begun to be looked into. And a major study was commissioned by the state to look into alternatives for the rest of Alaska. That was a Stone and Webster report that was actually produced in 1983. It was a five-volume, three-inch volumes of three-ring binders that are still legendary and actually is a good resource to look at sometime in the future when we're looking at projects that might be possible in the state of Alaska. So right about that time in the very late 70s is when the cost of oil spiked because we had the oil embargoes for the oil-producing countries, and the diesel utilities were hit very hard. And at that time, the very first program of assistance began. It was called the Power Production Cost Assistance Program. And it essentially covered the costs of diesel fuel, and it actually, there was no limit to it. It basically was a reduction in cost to diesel for diesel-using utilities. That program was established as a stopgap measure. It then morphed into what was the Power Cost Assistance Program, and that was a program that was designed to self-extinguish in 5 years. That began in 1981. While that program was underway is when the report came back saying that there really weren't any viable alternatives for rural Alaska. And so the legislature at that point said, okay, well then we have to go forward with a long-term subsidy program. And that's when the Power Cost Equalization Program was born. So they took the Power Cost Equalization Program and they rewrote it. They put in a floor, which, in other words, the cost of electricity couldn't drop below the floor. It was 8.5 cents at that time in 1984. Everybody got power cost equalization on the first 750 kilowatt hours that they used. Who was not eligible for PCE were the communities that were served by the rail belt and the four dam pool. So basically there's actually language in the enabling legislation that says that communities served by the four dam pool, the five communities, three in southeast and Kodiak and Valdez and Copper Valley area, were not eligible for the program. And any utility that was not 75% or more served with diesel in calendar year 1983 was not eligible. So it was many years later that the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund was born. That actually occurred in the year 2000. And this again was formed out of a quid pro quo for programs that already existed. Now, power cost equalization was being funded with 60% of the receipts from the four dam pool projects. When the state decided to divest those projects back to the communities that were served by them, which occurred in 2000-2001, the proceeds from the sale of those projects was devoted back into the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund. At that time, you have to remember that the four dam pool communities, a total investment of about $450 million was made to build those four projects. And when they were sold in the year 2000, the net proceeds that they sold them for was $74 million, so a little less than 20 cents on the dollar, which is why there was a $100 million CBR match that was brought in for that first deposit into the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund. There were two additional deposits into the endowment fund. The first was in 2007, and the last one was in 2012. And Senator Hoffman can give you much better reasoning as to what the quid pro quo was for each of those two deposits. They were all basically a rural-urban consensus on here's our priority, and in order for that priority to go forward, here's what we're going to do for the rural communities. And so it went into the endowment fund. So a total of about $740 million was deposited in the endowment fund. Now, the way that the endowment fund works is that the average value of the preceding three full fiscal years is used to determine what the amount is that can be spun off for PCE. And until 2015, it was 7% off that average total amount. So the endowment fund didn't actually pay for PCE for several years because when you look back 3 years, it wasn't spinning off enough revenue to pay for it. So there continued to be a general fund and an endowment fund balance for funding. In FY16, in other words, in calendar year 15, the program was revamped, and it was revamped to have a more realistic target for earnings of 5%, And so that's the maximum that can be spun off now for the power, not just power cost equalization, but the clever language in there that has really benefited the entire state is that the returns for a calendar year after PCE is paid for, 70% of the remaining balance can then be appropriated to pay for first municipal assistance of up to $30 million. And then if there's anything left over, it goes to the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, which also benefits the entire state. And I think the first year, FY17, we were able to spin off $30 million from municipal assistance and another $15 million into the Renewable Energy Fund. And again, for FY18, there will be enough funds to pay for municipal assistance and a pittance for, I think, the Renewable Energy Fund. So looking at what's happened between 1985, which was the inception of PCE, and 2017, which is the last year for which we actually have the PCE annual report, that usually comes out early in the year, so we should have one for FY18 in the near future, but this is just looking at 2017. So what has changed? So the floor, which started out at 8.5 cents, has gone up to 19 cents, so it's just over 19 cents a kilowatt hour. So that's the minimum that every utility has to pay, or every consumer has to pay. The ceiling of costs has gone up from 52.5 cents to a dollar. What that means is that the cost to operate a utility, and I'm, you know, an extreme example is one that has always been extremely high, and that's Lime Village. So if you look at Lime Village, their cost of to produce electricity is almost $2 a kilowatt hour. So only the first dollar is covered. So they pay that 19 cents plus another 5% of the difference between 19 cents and a dollar, and then 100% of the costs above a dollar. So electricity continues to be very expensive there, and in other communities, there's a few other communities, I think there's 12 altogether, where the cost of producing electricity is more than a dollar a kilowatt hour. So those are the extremes. The amount of electricity that's eligible for PCE has been reduced from the original 750 kilowatt hours down to 500 kilowatt hours. Consumers, only the first meter that they have is eligible for assistance. So if you have a home in Grayling and you have a home in Bethel, only one of those homes is eligible for PCE. All the commercial users were taken off the program, and that occurred also about 1999. Schools, federal buildings, and state-operated buildings are not eligible for PCE. So the number of eligible users has gone down dramatically. So that accounts for 6,000 commercial customers. The fuel cost is up. Back in 1985, the average cost of a gallon of fuel was $1.17, and I think the most recent year was $2.56 or something like that. So it's up 127%, but efficiency has grown at a very dramatic pace. In 85, I think we were selling about 10 kilowatt hours a gallon on the PCE in all the PCE communities. Today, it's about 13 kilowatt hours a gallon, so a big difference. Non-fuel costs have gone up, but not nearly as much as you would expect. They're only up 31% on average on cost per kilowatt hour. The current funding is $28 million. That's not the highest it's ever been. I point out that in 2009, I believe, it was up to about $41 million. So that was immediately after the year of very high fuel cost. And so that's when the PCE funding was much higher, a much higher need. To put it in perspective, in 1986 or FY86, the total spent on PCE was just under $18 million. And the cost in FY17, 30 years later, was $26 million. So not a huge increase. So this is at a glance showing you what the program changes have been since FY86. It's just some statistics. You can see that the total sales in the communities has doubled from 225 million kilowatt hours to 463 million kilowatt hours. But eligible sales have only gone up a tad, and that's because of the changes in the program. I think what's important is to go down to the very bottom of that slide and you look at the percent of total costs that PCE covers. In 1986, 32% of total costs were basically covered by PCE. In 2017, it was only 16%. So what that means is that 84% of the cost of generating electricity in PCE communities is borne by the local community. So now a little bit about AVEC itself. For those of you that aren't familiar with us, we were incorporated in 1967. And in fact, this year is our 50th anniversary of our annual meeting, our first annual meeting. One of our first board members and the president of the board was Willie Hensley. Maury Thompson was one of our board members. You know, there a lot of Jimmy Hoffman. There were five. They were appointed by Wally Hickel, and we were the result. We now serve 58 villages, 32,000 population approximately. So we represent about 38% of all of the PCE population, or PCE served population in the state. We represent about 41% of PCE that's dispersed because our communities are smaller communities, and smaller communities typically are slightly higher PCE per capita recipients because the economies of scale are so poor. Just to give you an idea of the size of communities, we have at least half a dozen communities that are less than 100 population. Shagluck is the smallest right now at 77. Anvik is always contending to be the smallest, and I think it's about 81 right now. And Bethel, of course, is the largest at 6,200. Bethel is a fairly recent addition to AVEC. In 2014 is when we took over the for-profit utility that was operating in Bethel. We also recently acquired Yakutat. That was in 2017, so we have a presence in Southeast Alaska. Although actually one of our earlier members was Angoon, so we were in Southeast Alaska back at the beginning. But we helped to form what is now Inside Passage Electric Co-op, and we turned over Angoon to them and helped them to energize four other additional communities. And of course, we're almost entirely Alaska Native population. So this is a bit of a blurry map, a little bit, you know, squished, but that shows you where our communities are, and you know, Yakutat and Southeast. So I like to tell folks that our farthest north village is Kivalina, farthest south is Old Harbor, and that's about 824 miles. Farthest west is Gamble, and farthest east is now Yakutat, so that's over 1,000 miles. So that's a pretty large area to hop around in. We own and operate 50 power plants. We have 13 wind systems that serve 20 villages. The most recent wind systems were the two 900 kilowatt machines that we installed, one in Bethel and one in St. Mary's. And with the addition of those two, we added five communities to the number of villages that are receiving electricity from wind. Obviously, we have more than 170 diesel generators, a zillion trillion fuel tanks that always need something done to them. And we burn about 8.5 million gallons of diesel fuel a year. By the way, we also own two tugs and barges. We're the only utility in the world, I think, that owns their own waterborne vessels to deliver fuel to our communities. So we serve about 11,500 services across the state. We sell about 118 million kilowatt hours. To put that into perspective, Chugach Electric sells about 15 times as much as we do. And they serve Anchorage and Hope and Whittier. So we're pretty proud of what we do for not very much. Our average revenue per kilowatt hour is about 44 cents. The residential revenue is 48 cents. And the average residential user uses a little less than 400 kilowatt hours a month on average. And last year, power cost equalization was 21% of our revenue at $10.7 million and represents about 41% of all PCE that's dispersed. You may ask what happens to our revenue if PCE goes away. Nothing happens to our revenue. It remains unchanged. All that happens is that the burden to pay that additional $10.7 million gets shifted back to the community, to the residential users, and to the community facilities. That's where it comes from today. Do you have a question?
On that point, I know it would have to be probably an anecdotal comment, but if what would life look like if it was to go away?
It would be very bleak. To put it into perspective, in one of our average communities, PCE pays about 50%, a little more than 50% of the electric bill for a residential user. when they go over 500 kilowatt hours, they're paying about 50 cents a kilowatt hour. So if you plug in a little electric heater and run it for 3 or 4 hours a day for a month, you're going to add 700 kilowatt hours to your electric bill, which translates to $350 a month. Energy already represents an enormous component of the disposable income that a household has. The average household income in our communities is, I think, about $21,000, of which 70-some percent of the population are below the poverty line, and it represents about a third of what the average income is in urban Alaska. It's not a cash economy. And so having to come up with that extra cash to pay for a higher electric bill would cripple the household. But what would really be impacted is the community facilities. So the water and sewer facilities, the street lights, what few there are out there, the city hall, whatever little public services they have in the way of public works and VPSO programs, are basically they all receive PCE on 100% of their kilowatt hour usage. So for the cities, PCE represents typically two-thirds or more of their electric bill. If that were to go away, there are a lot of communities that would simply not be able to pay to have a person in City Hall even a few hours a week to answer the phone. So water and sewer facilities are the ones that worry me the most. If you were to talk to the Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative, which is the water and sewer nonprofit operator that ANTHC operates, mm-hmm. they operate about 27 or 28 rural water and sewer systems, and they essentially help set the bills and send out the bills and collect the revenue from residents for their water and sewer services. It is fairly typical for a residential user to pay $200 to $300 a month for water and sewer services. If they did not have PCE to help with that, their bill would go up, I'm told, 40 to 50%. So you're looking at an enormous impact both from their personal residential bills and from the municipal services that can no longer afford those subsidies.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Can you give the committee an idea what 500 kilowatts pays for? Like,
Senator Hoffman, for the chair, I would be happy to do that. As I said, the average consumption, residential consumption for our consumers is 397 kilowatt hours. During the summer, it's actually more like 200 to 250 kilowatt hours, and during the winter, it's nudging up and above the 500 kilowatt hours. You have to remember that in rural Alaska, subsistence is very, very important. And so harvesting goes on year-round, and all of that harvested food is stored in freezers. It is quite typical for a household to have two, three, or more freezers. And the freezers by themselves account for about 60% of that average 397 kilowatt hours that they're using every month. Lighting typically is a very tiny component of the electric bill. It comprises less than 20%. So you have lighting is probably 40 kilowatt hours a month. Refrigerators are probably another 50 kilowatt hours a month. And then you have the freezers, which are the primary users. In the winter, you also have heat tape consumption, because if you have water and sewer to your home, you're responsible to keep the connection to that water and sewer service thawed. And so typically you'll have a heat tape or two or three. And I do calculations on all the different types of heat tape and how much electricity they use so that people understand what that consumption is and to learn to control that usage, put them on a timer, whatever it is. There is very little, I mean, there's just not much that can be done to curb electric usage in residential homes in rural Alaska, because they've already got the ultimate controlling factor, which is what happens when you use over 500 kilowatt hours. It's a pretty good deterrent. So it's nothing compared with what I use in Anchorage, for example.
And that was my follow-up question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
What is the average consumption like in Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau?
Well, Senator Hoffman, through the chair, you know, that that number has been coming down because there is conservation that's been going on. I know that when I moved to Anchorage in 1997, I was just so entranced with 9-cent power that I had my husband rush out and put Christmas lights up, you know, lots, I think 22 strings of Christmas lights. And I got my first electric bill, and I had gone up to 1,900 kilowatt hours, and I was absolutely aghast. I mean, my God, I didn't know anybody that used that much. So, yeah, he had to go outside and pull them right down again that following January. So we never did that again. But I was using about 1,200 kilowatt hours a month, and I was able over time to monitor and control my usage. And I'm down now to about 500 to 600 kilowatt hours a month. But the average in Anchorage, I believe now, used to be 750 and is now about 650 a month. I think in Fairbanks it's a little higher. In Juneau it's much higher. So those are the three that basically roll together to set the floor for PCE. I would say it's typical that a rural household uses half to 60% as much electricity as an urban household, and that's with urban households doing a lot of conservation in their consumption.
Senator Costello has a question.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having the presentation. And, Mira, it's great to have you here, so knowledgeable, almost as knowledgeable as one of the members.
not quite, but...
I was just curious, was there ever a conversation about having PCE cover schools?
That has long been a conversation in many different fronts. The issue with PCE for schools or any other facilities that are paid for by the government is that it's taking it out of one pocket and putting it into the other. And so adding schools would drive up the cost of the program very, very substantially. And the beneficiary really in the end would be the state funding formula. And so I think that there has been a reluctance to do that in any meaningful way just because of the cost that would happen to the program. I can tell you also that hearkening back to 2009, which is when we experienced the fallout from the very high cost of oil, Fairbanks made a fairly sustained effort to perhaps get included into the PCE program because they were paying 25, 26 cents a kilowatt hour at that time. And the floor in 2009, I would have to think a little harder about it, but it's probably about 13 cents a kilowatt hour. So arguably, it could have had a very substantial impact on the PCE program. Now, they're specifically excluded in the language, but there was talk about revising the statute and allowing, you know, any community that is above a certain threshold to fall into the program. And I know that Senator Hoffman's office had an economist's run numbers as to what that would equate to. And at that time, the program cost was $42 million, and it would have gone up to $75 million is my recollection of what that crunched out to be if Fairbanks were to come on board. So that just gives you a perspective. It's not exactly the answer. I will tell you that in our communities, schools typically represent 30% or more, 30 to 35% of all of the electricity sales that we make in that particular community. And so if we have a community where 50% of the PCE, of the kilowatt hours are eligible for PCE, adding the school would take that village up to about 80% being eligible for PCE. So you quickly get a feel for what that would mean to the cost of the program. It would add about 30% to the cost of the program.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you for that information. And I do understand it's just essentially placing it in another pot. However, I know this is somewhat unrelated, but I actually am interested in parsing out the foundation formula and identifying where the energy costs are coming from and the building costs, and so that we can have some transparency in what dollars are actually getting, you know, to the classroom for education. And the foundation formula is its own beast, so to speak, mm-hmm. but it is something that I'm interested in, and but I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know that this is something that has been you know, I used to live in Naknek, I used to live in Cordova, and it was something we used to look at very hard because there was the target was that 70% of the appropriation should go into the classroom. But when you have school districts where you have very high costs of operation, you just can't achieve that 70%. Just to keep the lights on and to keep the building warm is a huge drain on those funds.
Senator Birch, you had a question, sir?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see you, Mira. I had a couple things. Well, first of all, I can remember visiting Brad Reeve up in Kotzebue, and I swear he was doing wind energy before wind energy was cool. I mean, it was 20 years ago, the wind diesel. And I guess I'm how do you see that fitting in? I know, you know, we've had I wasn't a big proponent of the wind farms in Anchorage because we're sitting on a lot of gas. But can you speak to, you know, what percentage of of your membership, if you will, is supported by renewables, you know, wind or solar or hydro or otherwise, through the chair?
Senator Birch, through the chair. Yes, Brad actually started his wind program up in Kotzebue in 97, 98, mm-hmm. and put up the first what were then the Atlantic Orient Corporation wind turbines, those little 66 kW ones. And we actually started a joint effort with Kotzebue. So it was an AVEC Kotzebue project to put high penetration wind in Wales. And that was, we started that in 1999. And so that actually came to fruition. It was a very novel, first of its kind in the world, high penetration in an Arctic community wind project, and required a lot of players at the table to make it happen. We were able to demonstrate the ability to go diesels off in Wales, but it was a struggle. It was a huge struggle. It was a turbulent area. What we learned was that obviously we know the wind regime is best in the deep of winter, which is when it's coldest. Wales is a very cold community. When the diesels went off and they had to come back on again, guess what? The lube oil had gelled, and then, it was a nightmare. It wound up costing three times as much as it was supposed to have, but it proved a point that it was technically feasible, even if it wasn't practical to do. So we've had a fairly aggressive wind program. It was starting in 2003 after the Wales project. We built a project in Selawik, and since then, I think Kosiegluk and Tuksuk Bay were the next ones. So we actually have demonstrated some of the highest capacity factors really in the world, because we have them in good wind regimes. It's been a cobbling together of various funding sources. The primary funder was the Denali Commission. Then in later years, after 2008, we've gotten a couple projects funded through the Renewable Energy Grant Program, which has been fabulous. So I would say our best performing system is probably Shaktulik, which is a small community, in windswept Alaska. And we've actually achieved up to a 42% displacement factor. So we at least 35% of our electricity comes from wind in that one small community. Where practical and possible and economically feasible, we connect communities together. And so we have a wind project, for example, that we put in Tuksuk Bay, and then we built tie lines to Tununuk and to Nightmute. So we have three communities that are benefiting from one wind project in Tuksuk Bay. And collectively, it displaces 25 to 28% of the diesel fuel that we would otherwise have used for electricity there. So we've done a lot with it. It's very capital intensive. It's expensive, a lot more expensive than it is in Kodiak or in Anchorage. The larger the wind turbine, the lower the cost per kW. A typical 100 kilowatt wind turbine for us is about $1 million installed. We do have the two 900 kilowatts that we just installed last year, and those ran us about $6 million, so you get, significantly more power for a slightly smaller per capita investment. But if you look at Chugach Electric and Siri and their 1.5 megawatt wind turbines there, I think theirs were about $2.3 million installed per wind turbine. So it's a really, it's a very different picture when you look at rural Alaska versus urban Alaska, because you have much more challenging geographic conditions. Transportation is a huge issue. Transportation, for us, is an enormous issue. We actually, we are adding $1 per pound for shipping to get materials to rural Alaska, because you take the 3 steps minimum that you have to have to get to that location. That drives up the cost. And then you don't have the heavy equipment there. If you're going to put in a wind turbine, you have to bring in a crane to do that. And so you have to rent a crane for the entire season in order to be able to get that installed. It adds a huge amount to the cost. But nonetheless, we own more wind turbines than any other entity in Alaska. We own 33 wind turbines, and we're pretty proud of them, by golly. No, not 36 wind turbines.
Wow.
So...
Follow up.
There's been some discussion. I think it was the Donlin Creek project, and they're looking at, you know, gas lines and generation and possible interconnectivity with other communities. How much of that do you have an opportunity to weigh in? Are you kind of hands off and stuff like that, or are you able to weigh in and kind of say, hey, that looks like a pretty good idea. We can, you know, get some generation going, maybe some infrastructure that will benefit a larger community. And I did have to look up and see where Lyme Village was at.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember.
Yeah.
I knew it was.
Slap bang in the middle. Senator Birch, through the chair. Yes, we've actually back in, I'm trying to think exactly when it was. So it was mid-2000s, 2005, 2006, when Donlin Creek first started getting talked about. The Denali Commission put together a small task force, and I was on that task force, and we basically were meeting regularly with Donlin Creek people to see what could be done to help with the energy needs. That was also about the time when Calista put together a conceptual, a major transmission project design that was anchored by basically coal generation and some other generation and a lot of potential wind generation in Bethel, and to look at bringing power to Donlin Creek. The challenge was at that time, and still is, it's about 170 miles from Donlin to Bethel, and you're going through some very heavily protected country. And although Donlin Creek is a very large load, Bethel is comparatively not a very large load. And so there were major logistical challenges. Donlin Creek's target was that they wanted to be able to get electricity for 12 cents a kilowatt hour or less. And so we did a lot of brainstorming with them to see what the potential, what the possibilities were, what the options were. And personally speaking, I think that the best option for them is my other project, the Alaska Grid Project, with mega generation at the North Slope and transmission down to Donlin. And when that comes about, it'll still be the best bet. But in the meantime, they have gone forward with permitting a gas line for themselves because they believe that they can buy and get gas delivered at a reasonable enough price that it should meet their needs. They are talking about a 12-inch line as opposed to what they would need for their own needs, which would be about a 10-inch line, specifically to provide additional capacity in case we are able to put together a concept of potentially generating power there, transmitting it elsewhere, or even delivering some gas to some local communities. The challenge you run into is that the local communities are so small and their energy demands are so small that it becomes economically very difficult to put together a capital project to provide that need. So we're definitely part of the discussion. You know, every time something happens on the horizon, I'm in touch with their Canada office and talking, well, do you have something more recent than the 2011 study? Well, not yet. But, you know, you'll be the first to have one as soon as we have one done. And I, you know, they're struggling with making it economically viable to develop that mine. And the gas pipeline is a $1 billion project. And, you know, if costs start to go up any substantial way, it's going to make their mine a little bit less economic. And so I think that they struggle with that all the time. My fingers are crossed. I hope that they succeed, and I hope that there'll be some opportunity there for us all to benefit from some major generation over there that could potentially serve a lot more of Alaska than just the mine.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue. Thank you.
Okay, so what I have here in this slide is what I put together is a series of questions. There are 11 questions, I think. And the first question is, does PCE actually reduce the cost of power to urban levels? And what I showed for you here is the cost per kilowatt hour of a residential cost per kilowatt hour in several communities, starting with Chugach Electric. At right now, it's almost 20 cents a kilowatt hour. Fairbanks is 24 cents. AELMP, bless their souls, is a little less than 12 cents. And they helped to bring that average cost of urban power down to 19.02 because of their 12 cent power. Kodiak Electric with the Four Dam Pool Terror Lake project is a little over 15 cents. Kotzebue Electric after PCE is 19.5. Us on average is about 23 cents. And then I have three other communities, Bettles, 31 cents. MKEC is actually five villages, the middle Kuskokwim villages, and they're about 41 cents. And Napakiak is almost 50 cents a kilowatt hour. So that just shows you, no, it doesn't bring it down to Anchorage levels, but, you know, it gets us close. Taking that average 700 kilowatt hours residential electric bill, I calculate what that electric bill is before after PCE. And you can see the lowest is Juneau at $83. The next lowest is Kodiak at $107. The highest is actually Middle Kuskokwim at $421 for 700 kilowatt hours. So that just shows you a comparison. In the winter, it is not at all unusual to have a 700 kilowatt hour bill in rural Alaska. This is the electric bill that you would face if you were in that unfortunate predicament. So who gets PCE? I've already touched on this. It's residential consumers for the first 500 kilowatt hours and community facilities. There is a cap on how many kilowatt hours a community facility can get PCE for. That cap is calculated by taking the population as confirmed or affirmed by DCRA every year and multiplying it by 70 kilowatt hours. So 70 kilowatt hours per resident per month is the cap, and there are a few communities that pierce that cap, and I will, one of them, for example, is Selawik. Selawik has a long water sewer distribution system that was installed about 15 years or so ago, and they have some leaks in the system, so they use a lot of heat tape. The municipality uses a lot of heat tape to keep that system functioning, and that drives up their cost, their electricity. So they actually, they pierce the cap every winter. So hopefully one of these years they'll figure out where those leaks are and get them stopped, and then they perhaps won't use as much electricity because they're paying full price for everything that's above their cap. So the community facilities are streetlights, washout areas, water sewer facilities, and community buildings. So a building that's paid for by what they call private commercial interests or insurance companies, et cetera, is not eligible for PCE. Most village clinics are eligible because they actually simply get an allocation from IHS, and it doesn't go up or down based upon their electric bills, so it's deemed to be eligible for PCE. But it's always a battle to get facilities certified for community facility PCE. So,
Senator Hoffman. And under commercial customers, I do believe that people that rent teachers that come in and other professionals that come in that are not homeowners that rent have to pay are not eligible for PCE?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, what happens is that very often a school will own, will build apartments for school teachers.
Like in Bethel, teachers come in.
If they are not actually the ones that are paying for their electric bill, it's in somebody else's name, and that somebody else is not eligible for PCE. So YKHC, for example, if they bring in medical personnel and they're putting them up in housing, the housing is all paid for by YKHC. So no, they're not eligible for PCE. What we do tell school districts, you know, certainly out in our communities, is that If you are able to put have your teachers put the electric bill in their name, they are residential facilities, they will be eligible for PCE. But so very often the school does not want to do that, and so they lose the opportunity to get PCE.
So if a teacher comes in and rents on their own, they're not eligible?
They are eligible.
They are?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's in their name, they become the consumer, and they are eligible.
Is that the case for all other individuals that rent?
Yes. Renters, we are indifferent to whether they're owners or renters.
Okay.
It's a matter of who's responsible for the electric bill. And when they sign up for service, yes, they get PCE. So who doesn't get PCE? The schools don't get PCE. State, federal, commercial customers, and consumers that have seriously delinquent accounts. So there's actually in the statute that a consumer has to be paying their electric bill in order for them to get PCE. It's rare. In our system, we don't have any consumers that are not getting PCE because they're so delinquent, because if they're that delinquent, we've cut them off. And so they're not using electricity, so they're not eligible for PCE. But there are some communities where collections are not the greatest, where, you know, they only collect 70 or 80% of what they bill. So in those systems, it's a struggle all the time. Which leads me to tell you, I must boast a little bit, but our delinquency, we write off less than 0.5% of our total billed revenue annually. So our customers pay. So how does it work? A utility applies to the Regulatory Commission to participate and submits all the required information, and then the RCA makes a determination of what the eligible costs are, and they set the PCE rate. So we bill the customer based upon our normal tariff, and then a portion of that bill is credited back as a credit to the customer, and then at the end of the billing cycle, we bill the Energy Authority for all the PCE that we've credited. And then the Energy Authority goes through and examines all of the bills, makes sure that we did it right and that we didn't overdo it or underdo it, and then eventually they pay us. So the consumer has to pay the electric bill after the PCE credit. We provide a monthly detailed billing report to the Alaska Energy Authority, and then they reimburse based upon that. And then annually, we're required to update our filing with the RCA, so they get a very detailed filing showing all of our costs, and then they determine from that what our eligible costs are, and they set our PCE rate. So a common question is, doesn't PCE discourage conservation and innovation? After all, why should I save if I'm paying so little per kilowatt hour, and why would the utility invest money in overhauls and renewables when PCE is covering a lot of the cost? And my answer to that is that's because most of the electricity that's sold is sold to people that aren't getting PCE. And so you have that incentive to continue to lower, keep costs as low as you can. So with us, it's a major driver is to keep those costs under control. I can't speak for all other communities and how they operated, but I can tell you that that 52% that doesn't receive PCE is what keeps me awake at night. I do want to point out that the larger the community is, the smaller the percentage of kilowatt hours that are eligible for PCE, because they have typically a larger commercial base. So if you look, for example, at Cordova, they have the processing community. I think only, do I have them? Yeah, 28% of their kilowatt hour sales are eligible for PCE. In our average village, it's about 48%. So the smaller the village, the higher the percentage that's eligible for PCE.
Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've never seen a map that showed the communities that benefit from PCE, and I when I see Cordova on there, I'm just wondering how widespread that is across the state, southeast, interior, along the rail belt, for instance, through the chairman.
Senator Birch, through the chair, the annual report that the Alaska Energy Authority produces, one of the early pages of it is a map of Alaska, and it shows all the eligible communities in there. And yes, they are throughout the state. Rail belt, if they are in the rail belt system, they're not eligible. But, of course, you do have Southeast Alaska, You have several communities in Southeast Alaska that are eligible for PCE. You have several Alaska Power and Telephone communities that are eligible. Interior. Now, the North Slope technically is eligible for PCE, but the North Slope borough actually subsidizes the cost of electricity and fuel oil for its seven villages. So their rate is 15 cents a kilowatt hour. So even though their costs are similar to ours, they're about 50 cents a kilowatt hour, they don't get PCE because the rate is lower than cost. So other than that, it's ubiquitous. It's all over the state.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
So a common question is, doesn't most of PCE go to pay for overheads? I get asked many times about our overheads, and so we don't have overheads. We have costs of operation. You have fuel costs, and you have non-fuel costs. And so I give you a breakdown a little bit later of what some of those costs are. But if you look at the latest report, you'll see that in all the PCE communities, total fuel costs were almost $78 million, and non-fuel costs were about $85 million for a total of $161 million. PCE was $26 million. So only if you look at it on a percentage basis, it was only 16% of total costs were covered by PCE. And on a fuel alone basis, it was 34%. So there's a large gap there. PCE doesn't begin to touch non-fuel costs. It is only paying a fraction of fuel costs. So what are overheads? There's that big question. They are all non-fuel costs, which is operating and maintaining power plants, tank farms, distribution lines, customers, billing, collections, administration, insurance, accounting, engineering. I just got my insurance bill for this coming year, since April 1 is our renewal period, and it's $1.4 million. So it's a big chunk of change when your total revenue is $52 million, out of which $27 million or $28 million is fuel. So it's a very large chunk of our non-fuel cost. So that's what overheads are. So here's what our non-fuel costs were for 2017. And it gives you the breakdown in cents per kilowatt hour for a total of about 24 cents a kilowatt hour. And our fuel costs were about 22 cents a kilowatt hour. So that shows you where it all goes. Another question that I get asked is, well, you know, in villages, you don't have any investment. It's all paid for by the state or federal government. Well, that's not true. What I have show you over here is what is the actual investment per customer. This is non-grant funded dollars per customer invested by the utility. And you will see that AVEC is at over $14,000 per service. And by comparison, Chugach Electric is $10,000 per service, and AELMP is 6.6. In the lower 48, that value is about $2,600 per customer. So that gives you a perspective of how much more expensive it is to serve customers here. And a lot of that is because if you look at our average village size is about 400 people, and we have about 200 services there. And you have to have a power plant, and you have to have a tank farm, and you have to have a distribution system, and you have to have power plant operators, and they're all serving literally a handful of customers. So those costs just get driven up. The other question is, there's this long-standing belief that PCE is somehow abused. But I say to you that it is not. There are very strict requirements that are met, that have to be met by a village. So if a village has, for example, high line losses because they're not billing correctly or they're not metering properly or whatever it is, if their line loss is more than 12% of what they generate is sold, then there is a penalty factor kicked in, and they are computed as if they had a 12% line loss, and so their PCE rate goes down as a result. And so there are mechanisms in place to deter line loss being too high. We, for example, our line loss at AVEC is less than 4.5%. So we are comparable nationally. That is a pretty darn good line loss to have. But that's because we work at it very hard. So it's achievable. But There are so many ways in which PCE is scrutinized that it is simply not abused. I actually think that it's underutilized. I look at some communities in the PCE report, and their non-fuel costs are 6 and 7 cents a kilowatt hour in small communities, and I just shake my head and go, I would love to go and spend a day or two at that utility and help them to ferret out what the costs are that they're paying from somewhere else that really should be calculated as part of that cost of providing service and should be appropriately figured into their PCE rate, because it's simply not possible. Let's see. Number 10, wouldn't PCE money be better spent on alternative energy? You know, $26 million a year does not buy a lot of alternate energy. So even if you took the entire $26 million cost for 2017 and put it into a renewable system, our average three wind turbine installation with the required control systems is about $4 million. So you'd pay for less than seven systems. In the meantime, 185 communities would go without PCE to build four systems that are going to, you know, basically provide 25 or 30% of your electricity. It's a parallel thing that would be nice to have, but you have to be realistic about what to expect with the money that's available. And you still need to have your base load generation. You still need to have that diesel generation and the tank farms and the ability to be able to serve that power when the wind turbines aren't turning. So the last big question, why are we subsidizing rural Alaska? We are because Alaska has had a long history of subsidizing energy. One of the questions I don't have a good answer to is to what extent. For example, I've been doing a little bit of research into the huge subsidies that went into providing gas power for, or gas access to Chugach Electric to be able to provide gas power in Anchorage. When I was in NACNIC in 1990 and I was looking into what in the Bristol Bay Basin, thinking that there's a possibility we could tap into some natural gas there, Chugach still had 25-cent contracts. So they were buying, they were still buying gas at 25 cents per megawatt hour, not megawatt hour, per 1,000 cubic feet, which was 4% of what we were paying for diesel fuel electricity back in those days. There is a... I'm looking into it, and I'm hoping that somebody will be able to find some history on it. But there are greatly reduced royalty rates for cook inlet gas that have been in place since the 1960s, and that was specifically to bring affordable energy into Anchorage and the surrounding area. And there continues to be some major built-in subsidies there. It's not a bad thing to subsidize the cost of energy, because underpinning all economic prosperity is affordable energy. When the tie line was built to Fairbanks so that they were able to start buying power from electricity, you may very well remember the big issue with the Knox gold mine, the Fort Knox gold mine, and how expensive their energy bill was, and that they were looking at basically shutting down operations when they were able to start getting a better rate for their power. And Golden Valley's load doubled in a year as a result of being able to bring in low-powered gas electricity from Anchorage. So every step of the way, the legislature and the administration have agreed upon compromises to be able to provide some degree of affordable power to rural Alaska. PCE still only impacts less than 30% of all the kilowatt hours that are sold in rural Alaska. So the rest of rural Alaska struggles. We are in a state of energy poverty and energy refugees all across the state. And the PCE program was a wonderful program, worked well for the first few years, then the bottom fell out of the oil market, and legislature started cutting back on what was being appropriated for PCE. PCE was underfunded for 15 years, from 1992 to 2007. It was funded at less than 100% of what it should have been, and that was after the program was drastically cut back to reduce the number of kilowatt hours that were eligible. When the endowment fund was finally created, there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears along the way to make that happen. And I
simply have to recognize Senator Hoffman and the yeoman's work, the undying work that he did to make this happen and to build that fund up to the level where it can now actually fully support PCE and hopefully support municipal assistance as well. So I think that's about it. There is an awful lot more that could be said about the program and how critical it is for not just rural but urban Alaska. I can tell you that urban Alaska would not be very happy to have 90,000 rural residents move to town so they could afford electricity. It simply is a balancing act, and it's something that we need to keep in mind every time there's an effort to use the endowment fund for other purposes. I will cast myself on my sword for that endowment fund, as will somebody else at this table.
Mayor, this was very comprehensive, and I can't thank you enough for the presentation, but I'll just tell you, I don't like paying 24 cents to Fairbanks.
I totally get it.
So if you had a magic wand, I got a couple of questions, but first off, if you had a magic wand for the systems that you run, what would you do?
I'd build this 2-gigawatt power plant at the North Slope and fire it with very, very cheap natural gas and provide electricity for 2 or 3 cents a kilowatt hour to the North Slope operations, build a transmission grid, send it around the state, put everybody on postage stamp wholesale power, let the distribution costs go where they might. We have actually, you know, we've looked at that concept many, many times over the years. It's never gone anywhere. But let me just tell you that for the last about 4 years or longer, more even, we have only sold about 6.2 billion kilowatt hours, that's billion kilowatt hours in the state. And we're a state that, as you know, as I delight in telling Texans that care to sit and listen, if you were to cut us in half, you'd be the third largest state. But we sell less than half as much electricity in this state as does Sacramento in California in its little community. We treat ourselves like energy refugees. We need to stop doing that. All of our natural resources are harvested and shipped instead of being processed over here, value-added over here, creating jobs over here. If we had affordable energy, we would be able to attract industry from around the world. We have certainly got the climate and the country to be able to accommodate that. We just need to stop treating ourselves like a colony state.
And I would echo your comments. And you know, I recently toured Iceland last spring with my wife, and you know how many years ago they were a poor country.
Yep.
And they finally said, we got to get off of diesel fuel and coal. And today, when you can bring raw bauxite from South America to there to smelt it, you don't have to say anymore.
No, it's 2 cents an hour.
And now they're a thriving. People want to emulate what they've got, you know, and we have the same assets. It's just if we could get 21 and 11 plus 1 to all pull in the same direction long enough to get there, we could be in the same boat. And I'll have to compliment the senator to my right, and I was glad to co-sponsor the amendment with him in SB 138 that mm-hmm. created that little paragraph mm-hmm. in there that you know what it does, mm-hmm. but it's still stranded. So gets back to your original question that, I don't know, maybe it is the answer, but for me, that's what government does. It invests in big infrastructure projects to lower the operating cost for everybody to grow the economy. So that's my 2 cents. Any closing comments by members?
Good program.
All right. Well, thank you so much for this meeting. This will conclude our meeting for today. At this point, I'm canceling this Thursday's meeting, and we will keep you apprised of our next scheduled meeting. And I want to thank my committee members for coming here today. And again, thank you, Mayor, for your presentation. We are adjourned at 4:35.